What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you say machines, I'm assuming you're meaning like AI is able to look at billions and trillions of data points and then give you the best possible outcome, and then leveraging that is probably going to be even more important.
I feel like AI has, it's like a yin and yang. UI and AI will actually need to work with each other. I might be jumping the gun, but you know, what machines can do to help here? Because there's only so much as an entrepreneur you could actually do.
As an entrepreneur, to be competitive at an early stage, we don't have the luxury of having a huge team to be able to do that for us. But now we have the competitive advantage, which is AI to a degree.
There was a big sort of civil revolution that happened around, but what came along with was more corruption, more dysfunction, the entitlement that actually arose, like, hey, we were the oppressed ones.
What's the strategy for an entrepreneur to launch a product that has so many potential applications? Because you're going very wide now.
You know, you might be small, but your biggest relationship is with the end customer.
Welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. HubSpot is a huge supporter of the show. I'm a huge fan of HubSpot, not just because they support the show, because they support entrepreneurs. And if you are an entrepreneur, you have some problems that a lot of entrepreneurs have: productivity. And it's not a secret. It's nothing to be ashamed of. You're not the only one that has this problem. And why do we have this problem? Well, all the tools and the tech that we're using, they're massively overcomplicated. We have tons of time-consuming tasks. Our teams are not getting the information they need to close the deals, connect with customers, whatever it is. As entrepreneurs and our teams, we all have productivity problems, but HubSpot's customer platform truly helps. It was built to save time and make your job easier so you can get back to building your business. No more hours wasted on time-consuming tasks. No more chasing down prospect info if you're trying to close someone. No more one system for this, another system for that. HubSpot can help you find leads, reach prospects, deliver the insights you need to convert them to customers all in one place. Plus, HubSpot AI can literally do more work for you so you can focus more on scaling your business, because HubSpot knows you have massive growth goals and they're here to make your productivity problem go away. Visit HubSpot.com to learn how they can help you grow better. Dheeraj, thank you so much for coming on. I'm very excited for our chat today. How I wanted to kick this off, because there's so many different topics we can go into based on all the different companies you've built and advised and helped. But when you look at like the evolution of software over your career, what would you think is the most notable evolution or difference between when you started building tech companies versus what you have to deal with when you're building companies now?
Yeah, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here, Scott. You know, the thing that has gone on in a very timeless way, I mean, even going back before I started building companies, is how big things have become smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Just we're atomizing every experience, and not just in terms of space and like, oh, the software is becoming smaller and more lightweight, but also in terms of time. Like, you know, people used to you know, buy software for 7 years and have support contracts for 7 years, to now people are doing not just monthly billing, but it's down to the last minute and the last second of usage in some sense. So I feel like it's happened to our personal lives too. I mean, we used to own these big devices, and then we moved to use, you know, these miniature things, and then it went on to even digital things, you know. So I feel like that's the biggest thing, and we have to keep sort of working towards just a more atomized experience all our lives, you know.
What does that mean for an entrepreneur?
You know, the biggest thing is, you know, really thinking about customer delight in a way, like every moment of the way you have to really create value, because people are being bombarded. There's so much stuff that's coming their way that every minute that you're actually spending with your consumer, you have to really delight them. It has to be worth it, because, you know, they have the opportunity to pull the plug and move on and do something else. Attention spans have reduced so much that design plays a very important role. And I feel like, I know I might be jumping the gun, but, you know, what machines can do to help here? Because there's only so much as an entrepreneur you could actually do. Maybe you need the help of the machine to really help you not just stay on your toes, but also crush it with this shorter attention span that we actually have with our consumers.
Because, and no, we can jump the gun as much as you want. We're gonna talk about all the incredible things that you've sort of built over your career. But I think that just to see your perspective through the evolution of how a product is built and how a customer responds, and I mean, I think there's definitely an evolution of UI, UX, and customer experience. And now we have, when you say machines, I'm assuming you're meaning like AI is able to look at, you know, billions and trillions of data points and then give you the best possible outcome. And then leveraging that is probably going to be even more important than ever before, because it's not just about creating the nicest thing that keeps people around the longest. Like we don't, as an entrepreneur, to be competitive at an early stage, we don't have the luxury of having a huge team to be able to do that for us. But now we have the competitive advantage, which is AI to a degree. I don't know if that's where you're going with that, but that sounds
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, even taking a step back and the consumerization of our experience, you know, in B2B software used to be extremely stodgy, and it was built for the buyer, and it was built for the buyer. You know? I mean, IBM sellers would come, and, you know, there was no such thing as learning from anybody other than the salesperson. You know, I mean, if you go back to the 80s and the 90s, that's how things were. And I mean, the channel was a big part of it, because there was no internet before the mid 90s. And I think ever since the self-discovery, the self-learning that a buyer goes through now, and I think the evolution of the grassroots, I mean, the fact that the grassroots has so much power now that you can just leave it to the buyer's decision, a top-down something. I mean, socially, we've actually evolved a lot, where products are not just bought and sold over, you know, whining and dining of salespeople sitting in buyers. It's a lot of it is now proved to me that my grassroots users would actually like it or even approve of it. I think in the last 10, 15 years, we've come a long way. And the big reason is because I think as a society, we've evolved where you can't really shove decisions, you know, whether it's software decisions or what have you, culture decisions down the throat of the, you know, people who are actually doing the hard work. So there's so much to really connect with the end users that used to happen in the consumer companies. I mean, obviously there was nothing to be taken for granted in consumer companies. And a lot of that has really seeped into enterprise experiences as well now, you know, which I think is massive. And, you know, what we can come to expect from designers, I mean, B2B in the last 5 years has really evolved, where design is playing a much central role, maybe in the last decade, I would say. And we learned a lot of that from Apple as well, because we were carrying an experience over the weekend. You know, Saturdays and Sundays were about a consumer experience. And here comes Monday morning, and all of a sudden, the whole software experience looks so different, because it's, you know, everything is about control and authorization and security and compliance and, you know, everything that was so soul crushing about it, you know, as opposed to, you know, I want to come to work and have some fun and have some joy at work as well. So you know, productivity, which again has been an elusive thing in at work, and happiness. The question is, how do you really bring both of them together? It's probably the big change that we've come to see. And speaking of machines, I think they'll play a big role. I feel like AI has, it's like a yin and yang. UI and AI will actually need to work with each other. I mean, to the extent where things were 10 years ago, if you think, go back to Slack, for example, you know, there was so much dopamine in this real-time collaboration and communication. You know, we were looking at the pulsating dots and say, wow, you know what, the other side is typing, so I shouldn't leave my laptop or my phone. I think there was so much of dopamine that was coming from real time. I feel like even Slack today looks quite last generation now, because it's not sentient, you know, it's not perceptive. It's still based in just all things human. When I think if you look at the help that these assistants can now provide, I think design will actually go to yet another level from where we saw 10 years ago of Slack and collaboration in real time and audio and video to where we really want to be in the next 10, 15 years.
That's so interesting how you bring that dopamine experience that people are so used to with all these, like you said, personal apps into the workplace. But that's what wins, because people, I think it's naive to say that people don't realize that even in a B2B environment, you're actually selling to humans and not like robots. But now people are getting to that point where they understand that they're actually selling to real people. Like, yes, you're selling to an organization, but there's like real humans with real emotions making a decision to buy your product or your service or your SaaS or your software. Walk me back, because this is great, and we will go down this rabbit hole in a second. Maybe just give me a little bit of your origin story, because obviously you're very passionate about designing an experience and selling to a human, not just an avatar or an ISP, or right? So you've obviously had some experience doing this just a few times. So walk me back. Even where did you come from? What informed your view of the world of building business? Did it come from your parents? Did it come from you were born in India, you came over here? So just give me like the origin story.
You know, the one thing that India and the Indian upbringing really helped me with was, you know, I got a lot of help socially from my maternal side, my paternal side. You know, my father used to work for the government, and this was the most corrupt government in all of India. You know, so there's state governments, and this was a little bit more to the north, south of Nepal, a state called Bihar. And there was a big sort of civil revolution that happened around, you know, the caste system was dissolved, and people really said, look, we need to really attain a lot of the luxuries and the power that these upper castes actually had since independence. And that turmoil really created a lot of dysfunction in governments too. And, you know, my state went through that big upheaval. I mean, the good thing is it was a bloodless civil war, so there was no bloodlet. But what came along with this more corruption, more dysfunction, the entitlement that actually arose, like, hey, we were the oppressed ones and we need to actually get a lot of... So I think, you know, there was a dark side to it. My father didn't get paid for like 6-9 months at a time because the government was dysfunctional. They didn't have the budget. They were running in deficit and they would be at the mercy of the federal government to give them loans and such, you know. So my maternal side, my paternal side, my uncles, my aunts, they actually helped me a lot. And, you know, we went through a good education, great education. You know, there was great, you know, schools, even in that corrupt state. I think it was, you know, just a luxury to actually go through great schools. My parents sacrificed everything, said, look, education matters. You know, you've got to go through the best education possible, even though things are actually, you know, it's hard to actually make ends meet. And with that, I think the word empathy actually just got ingrained. You know, I mean, I just felt like, look, if I have been helped, I need to help, and I need to really get in the shoes of others, because they got into my parents' shoes to really help me as well, you know. And I think I didn't have to learn the word empathy, because this idea of, but what are they going through? Something that just came naturally. And, you know, gratitude and, you know, even being a little bit more service-minded, you know, in the world of design, a lot of it is about being service-minded. I think has been ingrained in me. So when I was 17, I actually, you know, took some big risks. You know, I went to undergrad school for the first time when I was 16 plus, and then I quit after 3 months because, you know, in India, you have to be in this all India rank. You know, if you're not in the top 100 of 200,000 students back then, you can get to computer science. I'm like, you know, I really need to get to computer science. And this was 1992, when the internet was just about on the horizon. So I came back, it took a risk. I retook the exam. I got into the top 100, you know, got into computer science in 93. And in many ways, it was perfectly timed because the internet grew, the browser grew. I mean, there was so much that I learned about what was going on in the world as well. By 97, and I was still 21, I left India, came to the US for a PhD program at Texas Austin, University of Texas. And even there, I got a lot. I mean, the university paid for everything, or the fellow of the department. I mean, even to fly from India to the US, I mean, I didn't have the money. The university was not going to pay for the air tickets. And there were two really good conglomerates out of India, you know, Tatas and Mahindras, who actually paid for those things. So I have a lot of gratitude for, you know, people around me and corporations and companies around me, you know. And I feel like that has come to reflect in the way I think about consumers and users, and you know, the fact that they don't owe me anything, but I owe them a lot, actually. And it's really helped me think through design and customer support and service and all this stuff deeply.
I love that. When you started, and by the way, that's a beautiful lens to look at business through. I don't think that everybody just intuitively looks at business that way, but I think that's actually what probably leads to success. When you do adopt a very empathetic servant mindset towards your customers, I would actually ask you, because you know you have more experience than me. Do you find that it's even possible to build a business if you don't adopt that view?
I mean, people try because they feel like they have access, you know, to the bigwigs and the honchos and you know the powers that be, and it doesn't last. You know, unless you really connect with the people who are using it on a day-to-day basis. And if anything, as I mentioned, you know, going from perpetual licenses to subscription to now consumption, you have to be on your toes and really prove every day that you're worth it. So this servant mindset, you know, being subservient to the end user, if anything, is just coming to the fore like never before. And it's not just for the consumer. I mean, I look at the employees that you hire. You know, you need to have a servant mindset towards them as well. I mean, the best leaders right now, people ask me this question, like, how come there's so many Indian CEOs? I'm like, you know what?
Maybe there are a lot. quite a few.
And I feel like it's this thing about you don't have to thump your chest for everything. You don't have to really go and, you know, thump the table to get everything done. There's this, you know, thing about level 5 leadership, you know, how it can be extremely humble and still be fiercely resolute at the same time, which is very paradoxical. But this humble side of it is a servant leadership. You know, how can you be a servant to your employees and a servant to your partners and a servant to your customers? I think it's great business. You know, people in this day and age, they actually see through inauthentic stuff. And given there's so much fake stuff around us, that you know, being authentic is a great differentiator. And most people in the world, they can see through stuff. You know. And like, you know what, this is something I want to do business with. This is a person I want to do business with. This is, you know, kind of the disposition that I want with my vendor, my partner, and so on and so forth.
How does that, so fast forward, like, I mean, you've been building companies for over 20 years now, but now, you know, hindsight is 2020, that all makes sense and that all sounds good. And these are the people you want to align with. But I'm sure that over the course of your career, it didn't always work out perfectly. So like when you built Nutanix, that was several years ago. I can't remember.
2009. Yeah. In fact, it's been 15 years. And
geez. Okay. So 15 years of learnings. since then.
Yeah. And even before that, honestly, you know, when I got married to my wife in 2000, I was barely 25, and you know, we were going through the highs of the bubble, the .com bubble, and everything looked so hunky dory. And all of a sudden, within a year of the bubble burst, and of course 9/11 was painful, but between the two, there were two big, like, it was the double whammy, you know, for a young career coming out. I had dropped out of my PhD program, and I'm like, I'm going to work in the industry. And here I was, like, really looking down the barrel, and I'm like, and I was in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley was going through gloom and doom everywhere. But you just have to hunker down and say, well, keep learning, because the inputs are good, the outcomes will come someday. And I think I learned to build software and, you know, have some great camaraderie with people. If anything, that company that I was working for over those 3 years, it didn't go anywhere, but there were, like, you know, 6-8 of us were just mere engineers. We actually created about $30 billion worth of enterprise value by going and building companies ever since.
Phenomenal.
So I think being in a great company of, you know, people who just wanted to learn and be foundationally strong actually helped a lot. Like, what does it mean to ship great software, and what does quality mean? It's like the way quality was taught by the Germans and the Japanese, and, you know, many, I mean, think about customer service at Nordstrom and Amazon's customers, all about quality. So if you learn about quality early on in your life, and then I was fortunate enough to have a great manager in my, so after my startup stint in 2002 and 3, I went and cooled my heels at Oracle for like 4.5 years. And I learned a lot about, you know, shipping big software to big companies and still figuring out how to change the wings of a plane at 35,000 feet and make a lot of change to Oracle's core kernel code. And but then I think I had the fortunate sort of thing of having a great manager, you know, just who in many ways taught me excellence, you know, because, you know, young, you have to be shaped by somebody who's just really good at defining excellence, what good looks like, as Brené Brown talks about what good looks like, how do you define what good, and she even has an acronym, WGLL, you know. So I got that WGLL from my manager and my manager's manager. I mean, Oracle, the database team was just phenomenal, you know, and I was only two or three layers between me and Larry Ellison, and it was a pretty flat organization, and some great minds who just taught me what good looks like. And then for a couple of years, I went to a startup, and in 2009, you know, this whole thing starts. And along the way, I think just knowing how to grasp authentic people actually became...
Well, that was going to be my question, by the way. It was like, how do you align with those people? Because the manager, the investor, the employee, the business partner, the co-founder, it can be a hit or a miss. So the lesson is there, align with authentic people, but how do you actually find these people? Because that will accelerate your career.
Yeah. I mean, look, like most things in life, Scott, you can't predict everything. The question is, how do you react to it? Once you know that your bet was wrong. And that's the biggest thing that I've learned in life, that I'm a big fan of Nicholas Taleb in this. You know, he talks about anti-fragility. Like, what does it mean to really go through a shock and emerge better than before the shock? You know, I mean, not just be resilient, but be anti-fragile. So I've had to make tough calls in my entrepreneurial journey to actually say, look, I don't want to work with this person. So either I move on or they move on, you know. And because life is short. I mean, you're doing this not just for customer love and, you know, delighting the market and, you know, winning. Winning is a big part of entrepreneurship as well, because it just gives you so much of endorphins and dopamine and so on. But it's also because you want to come home and, you know, be authentic with your kids and your spouse and all that stuff. So you can't lead a second life outside when you're dealing with flying balls all day long, you know, and you have to really, you know, think hard about how do you deal with them and so on. So in many ways, I actually figured out a way to part ways with such people, because as I said, you know, life is short. And you are defined by the company of people around you. And if you start to go down this slippery slope, and it is about, again, lowering the bar on what good looks like and what truth is and what being authentic is, eventually every day you're making it worse and worse. And going back to the word quality, I think the quality of what you think awesome people are, you start mm-hmm. to just keep lowering the bar, diluting it, you'll become one of those people over time. You know?
That's really powerful too, because it's very scary to be an entrepreneur. because you grasp onto anything and everything. You grasp onto the wrong investors. You grasp onto the wrong employee. And out of all of the technical lessons that you could most definitely teach, I think that the ability to walk away from the wrong people is probably one of the most impactful, because that can, transcends any part of your
business. And I feel, I feel there's two big values. By the way, Yuval Harari talks about these two values in Sapiens too. I don't know if you have Sapiens in the library somewhere here, but I'm a big fan of Sapiens, the book. And he talks about two big qualities that, I mean, drives humankind at large, but liberty and equality. And, this idea of fairness and this idea of autonomy drives me like there's no tomorrow, you know. And when you see inauthentic people and you look at unfairness and inequitable sort of things that they do, I feel like it's the worst thing I can do to my life and to teach what my children should learn and how I should really, conduct myself. You know?
When you look at, there's millions of lessons that you've learned over your career. Let's like try and pull out just one major learning from Newton Nix that was probably the most impactful. It could have been. I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Today's show is brought to you by 1Password. Now listen, we all have that one friend who's constantly forgetting passwords and needing help to get into their accounts. I have a solution. It's called 1Password. 1Password is the award-winning password manager trusted by millions of users and companies like IBM and Slack to keep logins, credit cards, and other private info safe in an encrypted vault that only you can access. No more sticky notes with passwords or using the same password everywhere. I've been using 1Password for a year now, and I can't recommend it enough. It saves me time from having to reset passwords and gives me peace of mind knowing my info is secure. With convenient features like automatic password generation and login autofill, 1Password takes the hassle out of passwords. You can use it on all your devices, iOS, Android, Mac, PC. Everything syncs seamlessly. And with top-notch security audits and encryption, your data stays private. So do yourself a favor and check out 1Password today. Go to 1Password.com/Clary and get a 2-week free trial. Let 1Password remember all of your logins for you so you can remember what really matters. That's 1Password.com/Clary for 2 weeks free. I just want to take a second and thank Policy Genius. They're supporting today's episode of Success Story. I know we all have kids. We all have families we want to take care of. And I personally checked something off major on my to-do list, life insurance. It's a tough topic. It's really hard to think about, but it's so important. And the hard part was sorting through all the options. Luckily, I found Policy Genius. Policy Genius is an online insurance marketplace that makes getting life insurance surprisingly easy. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Now, knowing my family's protected brings me incredible peace of mind. Don't put off this important decision. Check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. the scariest moment, the shit hit the fan moment, the I screwed up and lost X amount of hundreds of thousands or millions because I did this thing, that you'd want to like impart on an entrepreneur from the period of that company?
It goes back to how you have to weave through being the youngest kid on the block, you know, because there's a lot of incumbents, large companies, mm-hmm. you know, and many of them initially will entertain you because they're like, hey, what can they do to you? Mm-hmm. You sometimes even become partners with them. You probably run on top of them. So there's a, you know, in the layering of the cake, you probably might be partners. And then eventually they obviously want to get into your business. And that's what happened in Nutanix, you know, where we were, you know, basically partners with the software on which we ran on top of, you know, which was basically the infrastructure, the substrate of VMware, you know, of, and we were running this entire data center infrastructure is pure software on top of VMware. So they were partners. And now all of a sudden, you know, their revenue curve had actually flattened. Then they're like, okay, we need to get into new markets. And they, you know, decided to get into our market. Mm. And then they got acquired by the company that we were disrupting first, which was these hardware players with giant machines, giant boxes, EMC and NetApp. And so EMC acquired them. Dell became a part of this. So it's a pretty complicated miasma of like relationships and, you know, cooperation.
It's getting messy.
Yeah, it just got messy, you know. And I think there's two big lessons. One is, you know, you don't blink, because if you blink, they crush you. You know, you might be small, but your biggest relationship is with the end customer. And if you get that right, and if you think that the power is with the end user and the market is all powerful, then no amount of power of these incumbents can really bring you down, you know. And that is what we kept, just true to. I mean, and again, it goes back to how do you stay authentic with the market, you know, because we went out of the market, we had a competitive product to, you know, the incumbent, we ran on top of them. And we could have gone and tried to eat the entire cake. And we said, oh, just replace everything. And the customers are like, hold on, can we do one thing at a time first? And therefore, we had to run on top of our enemies and, you know, survive next to them. Because the customer said, I've had a 10-year relationship with these guys. So how can you go and try to replace everything, you know? And what that meant was that I had to lead a very schizophrenic life that, look, I can mm-hmm. replace the whole thing. You can get the whole thing from me. But at the same time, I have to insert this enemy's lair in the middle because you have a 10-year-old relationship. So authentically, I have to say my software has to run the best on both of these stacks, my stack and my enemy's stack. And I cannot be biased towards my stack. You know, I have to be biased to the market's way of thinking about it. And if I did that right, they will be my best protector, you know, and they protected us to the core. Because I said, if you just cared for me and no one else, I'll take care of you. And, you know, this is brilliant. This is beautiful. This is the best thing about the Western economies is the way companies are built is if you take care of the market protects you. And, you know, it really happened with us. The reason why we are an independent company and our biggest incumbent is now a private company, part of Broadcom, is because we had an eye for the market and we never blinked. And we did the, you know, best servant leadership with these guys. Say, look, we'll be the best customer support company. We'll give you the best net promoter score. Mm-hmm. When you call us, we'll never say it's not our problem. How about that? You know, never ever say it's not our problem. So because, you know, we were in this lead cake, there are things that ran on top of us. There are other things that ran on top of them. And sometimes you just call us saying, look, the end-to-end latencies are bad. Now, one could say, it's not my problem. You know, what are you doing above that? But we always said, we'll put the best people on this, you know, from customer support point of view. And they'll learn your applications, which are really not my software. It shouldn't be my problem. But they learn your applications. They learn how they're tuned and configured and all this stuff. And I will tell you the best way to solve that problem. So, you know, net, the biggest lesson in all of this was you could be small, but if you cared for the market is the biggest caretaker of such company.
How do you measure if you are catering to the market? Like, how, as an entrepreneur, I feel like my product's good. What's the KPI? What's the one North Star KPI that you look for as to whether or not you are, because maybe you are growing. Maybe your CAC to LTV is great. Maybe the numbers make sense, but is caring for the market and catering to the market, is there something that you should look for, something that you should establish so that if things don't go right, at least the market will protect you? Like what you just described, I'm trying to think of somebody who hasn't built a software product in the same context as what you've built. How do you look for that in whatever industry they're in?
You know, the obviously the big sort of Wall Street way of thinking about it is repeat business. Are you getting enough repeat business? And repeat business is a smarter business because you've already had the trust with the customer. They bought X amount of quantity from you, and now they're going to make it 2X or 4X or 5X. And by the way, they might be buying a new product from you. So both upsell and cross-sell are great sort of metrics of what trust means, that, oh, I trust you more and I trust you more and so on. But there's also the, I would say, the emotional side of it. Like in your conferences, how many of them show up? Because they're all busy people and they're, you know, really not just the grassroots practitioner, but even the folks who are CXOs, their biggest and the rarest commodity they have is time. So if they're able to give 2-3 days of their lives to your conference, I think it goes a long way to say, you know what, now you've quantified customer love. Because money is the easier thing. If anything, they're not even managing their own money. It's the company's money that they work for and so on. And eventually it's procurement and Gartner Magic Quadrant and all that stuff. But the fact that they're able to give you time, a couple of days of their time, because they don't go to 50 conferences. They probably go to 5 conferences. And the fact that they happen to be yours and they spoke up and you know, they were able to proliferate the power of social proof, because, you know, the power of social proof is the stuff that sometimes you don't even want to go out publicly and talk about in a press release. But when you're sitting next to someone and you're able to tell how much you've evolved and transformed and all this stuff, I think that is an immeasurable thing. But I think conferences go a long way in really defining what the market sort of, you know, love is for you.
I just want to take a second and thank the HubSpot Podcast Network for supporting Success Story. We're part of the network. If you love podcasts, the HubSpot Podcast Network has other incredible podcasts like Entrepreneurs on Fire, hosted by John Lee Dumas. Entrepreneurs on Fire is one of the OG entrepreneur podcasts. It really stokes inspiration, shares strategies to fire up your entrepreneurial journey to create the life you've always dreamed of. It has unlimited energy, value, and consistency. The podcast is truly for anyone who wants to learn more about entrepreneurship. If you like fast-paced, packed with value stories, this show is for you. John brings on great guests. He speaks about failures, aha moments, what's working for them currently. If you love podcasts, go listen to Entrepreneurs on Fire wherever you get your podcasts. I love that. That's a very good metric. I've never thought about it that way, but I think that's actually a perfect, because time is so, so valuable. That's a perfect way to measure it. Let's like fast forward a little bit to DevRev and what you're trying to accomplish there. And then I want to go into some more sort of philosophies that you hold about business, about data, about design, about democratizing data. We've spoken a lot about authenticity as a core concept, so I'm sure that's going to also permeate what you've done with DevRev and what you, how you've built this business. But I do want to understand like what problem you're trying to solve, because even before we jumped on to this call, you said some pretty prolific things about how DevRev is going to do something similar to what a very well-known company has already done to us. So maybe explain exactly what you're trying to accomplish and we'll go from there.
You know, I'm a firm believer of this kind of Gestaltian way of thinking about that. The whole is better and bigger than the sum of the parts.
Yes.
And you know, the biggest companies, the most successful companies the last 15, 20 years, and I can go back even 100 years, you know, they all have left shifted a lot of the complexity. They said, look, we'll reduce the number of things you have to deal with. So this extremely reductive way of thinking about things is what has created simplicity in our lives, you know. And it just, in the last 15 years, I mean, we have reduced the number of devices we had to really deal with. And by the way, these devices now talk to each other and so on, you know. And that was iOS. It was an extremely reductive way of thinking about our personal lives. And that's what Amazon did with AWS, saying, hey, just, you know, we have 10 teams to really spin up an app. Now you can do this with this one abstraction called a public cloud. And even there, a developer who is a have not, you know, they never get to make procurement decisions. I will have them make decisions. You know, how empowering is that? You know, so that's what Nutanix was about. It was empowering the have not, which is the application folks who are at the mercy of stitching six teams together and making budget decisions and who gets to do what, plan like big things and upfront and so on. But no, you don't have to plan at all. You can start small, you can keep adding, but we'll reduce the number of teams, the number of components. We'll integrate all this for you. We'll left shift all this complexity, you know. And, you know, so all that was happening in a personal infrastructure and IT infrastructure, data center infrastructure. I felt when I was running Nutanix that we had the same problem in business infrastructure. And there's tons of CRMs and, you know, every department has a work management tool, you know. It's called software work management from Atlassian, and it's incident management and service management with ServiceNow. And then there is ticket management and support stuff with Salesforce and Zendesk. And then there was sales management with Salesforce and HubSpot and all this stuff. Everybody has a work manager. But the problem is nobody knows why the company ticks, you know, and clicks with their customers. And it comes down to two things. It's product and the customers. You know, does everybody know everything about customers within the company? And does everybody know everything about products? You know, if we did both of these things well, then maybe we get to unify, and then work is adjunct. Ideally, we should not have to do as much work because hopefully machines do more work going forward. But why do we actually make work primal when it should really be product and the customer? So now, you know, this idea of building a knowledge graph really became the big thing for me. I'm like, we need to reduce friction. We need to reduce conflicts. We need to, you know, really bring the why of any company forward, and the why of a company's customers and product. You know, how is their, you know, sausage making, and the what is the KPIs and the work and everything that comes out of it. You know, so we built a knowledge graph around product and customers. Then we said, look, what do we got to do with this? It has to be eminently searchable, semantically searchable, which is the whole idea of AI. And then it has to be highly analyzable, which is, you know, the last 5-7 years of data warehousing in the cloud and stuff like that. But finally, we said, look, we can't stop there. We can't just be a bolt-on on top of existing stodgy business software. We have to rebuild the apps. Because, you know what? We need to rebuild the apps with AI being the foundation. Not AI being a lipstick on the pig, but AI being the foundation. Mm-hmm. How do you go rebuild apps? And that's what we did. We said, we're going to focus on customer support because, you know, I'm passionate about customer support. And, you know, it starts with chatbots. But chatbots are not the end-all and be-all of all things AI and customer support, because that's just one channel. You know, you have so many other channels of communication beyond the chatbot itself. And people and call centers and service staff and support agents and support engineers, they're here to stay. You know, I mean, let's not fool ourselves in thinking that the car gets fully autonomous overnight and we don't need drivers at all. You know, we still need drivers, and it'd still be assisted driving as opposed to fully autonomous driving, you know. So we took that problem and he said, we're going to redefine it. We're going to try to disrupt the support industry. But along the way, we also had to think hard about software development, because software development without support ideas and what's happening on the customer support side is meaningless. So we are really focused on these two things, you know, customer support and software development, using all things AI. Foundation is AI. And it is supposed to be delightful, as opposed to, you know, worrying about tickets and being buried in tickets the way things have been in the last 20, 30 years of IT.
When you think about building a product that touches so many business units, I mean, that to me is very stressful, because you say like riches are in the niches, and that's what people usually would push you towards if you're trying to build a new company. So if somebody wants to sell something where the buyers potentially could be a couple different people involved, what's the strategy for an entrepreneur to launch a product that has so many potential applications? Because you're going very wide now. And
the platform, and I really want to talk about the two things about running or building a new business, is you've got to think about the platform separate from the use case. So you've
explained that to versus, me. Yeah.
So, I mean, iOS was the platform.
Yeah.
Music player was the app, and camera was the app. Email was the app. So you got to have this iOS versus the app thinking, the platform versus the app thinking.
Yeah.
And to us, a customer support is a use case on top of the platform. And the platform is non-negotiable. It has to be something that really looks at all facets of the business, the product, the customer, the people, the work, the end users, the activities. And honestly, this is a great timing, because AI does not care about departments.
Correct.
Departments were created to organize human beings. But the only way for machines to actually be having better judgment and reasoning and, synthesis power. I mean, all this stuff only happens if you give them all the information about product, customers, people, work, users, activity, everything.
The whole business, yeah.
So, yeah. Because the linkages are there. There's a connecting the dots, which is what we as humans, when we walk the hallways, we listen to all that and we connect the dots. The only way for AI to be not hallucinating is if you actually give them the entire, what I call the knowledge graph, Therefore, the platform is extensible and it's actually omniscient, it knows everything. But now when you go to the use case, you go and build a customer support app, you have to make sure you don't violate what designers call the Maya principle. And the Maya principle is an acronym. It says most advanced yet acceptable. It's the most advanced platform thinking, but for a persona who only deals with customer support or product management, software development, they want a lot of the old world stuff in there as well. So we have to be really careful about platform versus app. You think horizontally, you think extensively, you think about, the entire knowledge graph, because the, the chain of thought reasoning and the synthesis power and the judgment ability of AI is very, very important. You can't compromise on all that. But at the same time, humans are still used to the creatures of habit. So you've got to give them something that looks and feels and walks like an old customer support software. The workflows, the security, and the notifications and the mobile app thinking, all that stuff. So you got to think about what's right for the humans and what's right for the machines. Machines want to know everything. And then humans want things the way they were done in the past, and we have done that really well. We built a platform that is AI native.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we built the app like a customer support app or the product management. We call it product CRM, the software development app. They just very much so have not violated the Maya principle, which is most advanced yet acceptable.
And then as you grow the company, now you have all these other opportunities that you could eventually go into if you like.
You're right. I mean, first is the ability to sell the platform, because you do want to go tell people that AI is meaningless without a knowledge graph that's extensible.
Yes.
But then you start with one use case and hopefully get to the second and third and the fourth. I mean, look, the iPhone was not like all million apps used on day one. You started with calling people.
Very true. Yes.
Putting your iPod in there. And it's like, okay, my music player is here. Like, hey, I like the camera a little bit now. Hey, you know what? The GPS thing, actually, I can remove my TomTom or Garmin and move to this. And then, hey, I don't need my BlackBerry anymore. My email is actually here now. It's secure as well. So every year, you took a step towards a new use case with the iPhone. And that's what we have to follow. I mean, start with a chatbot, get to customer support. you know, do product management, then software development, and hopefully over time we get to sales management and other such things too.
Obviously, data is wildly important in what you're building. When you look at, there's sort of two data concepts that are attributed to this, to this business, and also just business in general in 2024 and beyond. So the two are the democratization of data, and then data visualization as storytelling. These are both interesting concepts. So you've touched on, maybe you can start, maybe we can talk about the democratization of data, because you just sort of touched on that briefly. Maybe explain why that's so important from a business leader's perspective, why they want that permeation of data across the organization. I'm assuming it helps with, like, you know, organizational cohesiveness and shared knowledge. But maybe give me some ideas on that. And then I want to talk about data visualization, because I know nothing about that. So
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look, and societies, especially democratic societies, have evolved in this way where you're just giving more power to the grassroots.
Yes.
I mean, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, you know, we had a pretty hostile work environment in many ways. I mean, the Mad Men culture and, you know, even the backslapping culture, all this stuff was pretty awful. You know? And then we just have kept evolving to be better human beings. And a big part of that is basically democratize decision making and let people know more. Let people know more is the only way to reduce politics. And the information asymmetry is a big part of conflicts in organizations. But data is too expensive up until now, you know, where it can only be in the hands of a chosen few. We feel that to change cultures, to really, you know, bring all this, the fountain of youth and younger people to actually feel like there's a sense of meaning to the jobs. You know, I want to say that there was this recent Wall Street Journal survey that did like 2 weeks ago. Basically say the Americans don't care about their jobs anymore. And that is telling, just the fact that there's no sense of purpose in at workplace right now. Maybe since COVID, and I actually talked about since COVID days, people are moonlighting, they have multiple jobs. And the reason is because, you know, they don't feel like they're part of the decision making. And data is at the core of decision making. You know, you have to assume that anybody coming fresh out of college has immensely good analytical skills, and if you give them the data, they probably won't need to be shouted upon. You don't need to actually throw your badge and, you know, talk about your seniority of how much you know and how much more experience you have. So I think at the human level, data is important. But even at the pace at which, you know, companies are getting disrupted, you need to actually give more data to everyone at their fingertips now, today, you know, and to each one of us, you know. Obviously, you know, modulo authorization, compliance, all those things being considered as well. So if you've done a lot of work around democratizing data, making sure it's in the hands of everybody. And if you think of the biggest thing about, let's say, customer support, they feel like they're, all they're dealing with is like an emergency room. They're just triaging emergency cases. You know, when they are saying, look, I want to be actually in charge of healthcare. Like, I want to be preventative, not just reactive, not just go and apply a band-aid and then move them to some other ward or something like that, you know. And that means that they want to be in this round table, on this round table with product managers and software developers and, you know, cloud operators, you know, as opposed to being on a desk and just dealing with, you know, a swarm of emergency cases or something like that. And so that's an example of how do you democratize information about the roadmap of products and what's being cooked and where is it in the oven? Because that's what customers keep asking for. Is it done? And when will it get done? You know, and these are the things that, you know, support people are disenfranchised on, you know. So I think it's really important to reduce the information symmetry for an organization to feel like it can leverage AI to the hilt. And honestly, that's the only way you can let AI even be relevant and useful and a little bit more sentient and making decisions on your behalf, as opposed to just doing a ChatGPT next token for generating a summary of something. You know?
When you talk about, so this will sort of segue into using data in different ways. So when we talk about data visualization as a storytelling tool, storytelling to who? To everyone, to investors, to customers, to employees, to peers. where do we use data properly? What's a really good example of using data to tell a story to achieve a result?
You know, I'm a big fan of the New York Times, like not because of my political views or anything, but just the way they've looked at data. You know, that company, just like most of the newspaper companies, could have died, but they didn't. And the reason why they have flourished in the last 10, 15 years is because of design and visualization. Like, they tell stories in such a visual way that
when you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you so much, Indeed, for sponsoring Success Story. For all business leaders out there, Indeed is a lifesaver. See, we're always driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You're going to ditch the busy work and you're going to use Indeed for scheduling, screening, messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Clary. Just go to Indeed.com/Clary right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Clary. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, you need Indeed.
People are willing to pay through subscription. Like, hey, I'm willing to pay $30 a month because of not just the stories, because stories are a commodity now, but the way you tell it, you know. So I think that's one, like, and I really look at New York Times as a true North Star for visual storytelling, you know. I mean, even their games, like, I'm so hooked to their spelling bee and their Wordle and all this stuff that I feel like there's something about product building that starts with visualization and design that they have nailed. And not just now, but even from the last 100 years, they've been working on this. There's a big reason for it, because New York was always an ad industry. Creatives were there. Lots of really good designers actually, you know, came out of New York because of the ad industry. And I think that they've just leveraged the creatives in New York to really not just survive in the onslaught of Google and all the digital ad world that actually changed everybody's lives, but beyond that as well. And to now take that and apply it to a B2B realm is probably the most exciting thing that I think of. I mean, in the world of AI, everybody thinks visualization is dead, but I feel like...
Why do they think it's dead?
You know, it's because machines can make decisions. So why do we need to show anything to humans? Because obviously anything visual is actually more for humans. I mean, machines can interpret spreadsheet data or database data or records, which don't have to be visual at all. But if anything, I feel like humanism is here to thrive. I mean, you know what Warren Buffett says about making money? When the mob thinks that it's all AI, you have to go in the other direction. You know, it's fear and greed. When the mob is fearful, you get greedy. When, you know, they are greedy, you get fearful. I think it's the same thing here, you know. I mean, like, look, we overdid fully autonomous vehicles, like in the last 7 years, 10 years, like, oh, it's going to be completely autonomous. Driverless is the way to go. And look at who is having the last laugh. It's the hybrid guys. They're like, well, look, you did this well. It's not all EV. It's going to be hybrid. Yeah. And by the way, it's assisted driving. It's not fully autonomous. And I think that's equally true for machines and humans. I think AI is here to assist. You know, people ask me, so why are you doing this company? And I'm like, you know, there's probably 100 million professionals out there, but developers, support people, product managers. And we don't have to take anybody's job away. If we can just give them work-life balance, or just give their weeknights back, given how much of cross-country, cross-continent Zoom calling that's going on in the nights and the early mornings, that if you can just give them their weeknights back with design and AI coming together, I think we've done at least made a little dig in the universe. You know,
you speak about design as like the sort of the second component that's required for good companies, and you've mentioned it quite a bit. You speak about consumer grade design. I think we sort of touched on that briefly. We can talk about it a little bit more, but also, like, there's some examples. I've listened to some podcasts and I've looked at some of your work. So you're looking at examples of mediocre designs. So MySpace, Craigslist, Kayak, Windows Phone. Then you look at good design. So Airbnb, Instagram, Amazon, Reddit. It's so interesting that, in your opinion, maybe make like an argument as to why you feel like design is the reason why those companies didn't succeed. You're probably right. But I'm very curious as to, I've never heard that argument before, because I would have never thought design's important, but I would have never thought of that as the Achilles heel of some of these companies. Maybe Craigslist is pretty ugly, to be honest. But
pretty ugly. And look, they argued for function. They're like, look, it's functional. Yes. But the thing is, function is just the left brain. You know, there's a right brain to coming back to a site as well. Because there's an element of serendipity, like, oh, what is it going to tell me now? What's going to show me now? And so on, you know? And I think that is the cockiness that Craigslist went through. Like, hey, we don't need to do any of that stuff. By the way, part of the design thinking is, are you keeping with the tastes of the changing market? Because the younger demographics, and the younger demographics have different tastes. So you have to really transcend this generational shift that actually happens with the market, you know. And they were very arrogant about their opinion. Like, look, we know function, and function is good. It comes, you can do a search here. And when Google search came about, it basically just obliterated them. And there was so much more. I mean, just the simple search box, the one search box, was so much more powerful, you know. So I mean, a big, big student of design. I feel like whatever we are doing right now, I mean, I spoke of Maya. I mean, our biggest friend is design, and our biggest enemy is, you know, not thinking through what's most advanced yet acceptable. I mean, you talked about, oh, there's all these different kinds of use cases. How do you really bring it all together? Like, imagine 50 devices being shoved physically into one physical space. That couldn't have happened. So it had to be done with this idea that, hey, I can bring them together, a camera and a phone and a music player. And yet I want to make sure that when people are on the music player, they feel like this is the best music player, this is the best camera, and so on as well. So there was a lot of design thinking in what really led to these everlasting companies. I mean, look at Amazon versus even Sears, for example, you know. And I don't mean to say visual thinking is all about design. Customer service, no questions asked. Your thing gets returned. Costco is good design, really good design. You know, it might have an ugly warehouse, but it's a great design. No questions asked. 6 months later, you want to return something. That is customer service design, you know. So big, big, big fan of, you know, what it means to reduce friction. Making things frictionless is probably at the core of design. And sometimes it's about the best customer service with no questions asked. Because the moment you ask questions, people start to think twice about buying something again. Like, hey, but what if I need to return it? Nordstrom, they don't ask you questions about returning something, you know. That's why with this onslaught of Amazon.com, it still survives and thrives, actually, you know. So I feel like reducing friction is the core of entrepreneurship, of doing business, and therefore our design means a lot, you know, in pretty much that. Not just product building, but customer service building, go-to-market building, messaging, positioning, everything.
When you look at just one last thought, because I love now you've expanded the definition of design, which that makes a ton of sense now. When you look at evolving design needs and reducing friction constantly, so keeping in touch with the market, what's your strategy so that you don't become outdated?
Of course, a big part of it is respecting designers and bringing the best. I mean, celebrating design and designers. And by that, I don't just mean product designers, but many a time it could also be process designers. You know, like, customer service is a process design thing, you know. And sometimes even organizational design, Scott, you know, like the way you think about organizational design, you know, post-COVID, you know, I see the world is flat. Your book up here, Thomas Friedman up here, you know, somewhere. The world is indeed flat. The world is flat. So you've got to think about organizational design. You got to think about hiring as a design thing, because now if you want to get young people, how do you design your culture? All this matters, because if you're going to mix the most experienced people with the youngest people, you're going to get good stuff if you really thought about, you know, being empathetic to the have-nots. And sometimes the have-not is the young people. Sometimes the have-not is the experienced people, you know. And being able to get the best of both worlds, to me, is immensely beautiful organizational design as well. You know, getting the best people, like the way we've done it between here and Austin and Buenos Aires and Slovenia and Bangalore and Chennai and Mumbai. To me, it's when people say it's culture, it's all design. Like, what do you want to get Chennai to produce versus Bangalore to feel good about versus Argentina to feel great about versus Slovenia, and making it extremely diverse and at the same time equitable is behind.
One leadership principle that you stand behind is start with why. Why is that such a, because now I'm starting to see the threads between all the different things that you incorporate into your businesses. So why is start with why is such an important principle? Because I'm assuming start with why is like the, it's like the precursor for all the thought that we just spoke about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've become a big proponent of Greg McKeown's essentialism thinking.
I have that here too somewhere.
Oh, you have somewhere. I can see it. I can see it right behind, right next to the Startup Exit book, actually, you know, up there, you know, Startup Exit.
Yeah.
I can see it from here. You know, there's so much to do, and in the world has just talked so much about more of everything, that the only way to make money and to make sense and to have meaning is to do the opposite of that, which is do less. And start with why just helps you figure out how do you really get into this essential thinking. In fact, I'm a big fan of essentialism and essential. So in fact, we're proposing essential methodology. Like, hey, at the end of the day, you know, last 20 years, software celebrated agile. Agile is just being fast and continuous and, you know, iterate, which is like celebrating a lot of working forward, you know, and of course you might want to bring in the customer every once in a while. But I think essential is probably the opposite of that. You're like, hey, let's pause and think about what really matters. What truly matters? And are we working on the things that truly matter? And, you know, really going to open source this thinking about essential thinking, essential methodology. A big part of it for businesses is being customer centric, and which is more than just a cliche. Actually, you have to really define what customer centric means. And without access to data and information and sales and customers, you can be customer centric. So you have to democratize all that customer data. You know, the second one is being product led. You got to know what you build. You know, if you're not passionate about what you build, how can you sell it? How can you market it? How can you position it? How can you talk about customer success, all this stuff, without being product led? And then lastly, how do you be an AI native? Like, you know, can the machines do more so we can do less? You know, to me is a big part of, you know, just reducing the noise that's around us these days, you know. So start with why. It just helps you focus on customers, focus on product, and then focus on the last why. Why am I doing it if the machine can do it? You know, because then I can have
that's
a little
big
bit
question,
of work-life
balance. That's a huge question. Yeah. That's a huge, huge question. I love that question. Why am I doing it if the machine can do it? And then you optimize for tasks that you know a machine can't do.
Exactly. I mean, and then there's judgment and design thinking and humanism that the machines can do. Because now you're getting better at human-to-human stuff. I mean, and not just in business, but also in life with your spouse and your partner and your children. I think machines have the power to give us time back so that we can really, really, really have more meaningful experiences. I think that, to me, in this overall crest and trough of, I would say, civilizational building and evolution, we probably are at a point. That's why I'm such an optimist about AI and machines. I mean, you can always argue the dark side of everything, you know, dark side of internet, dark side of social media, dark side of mobile, dark side of nuclear energy and fire and water and everything else at a dark side, you know. But I think we've got to really balance the two and think about the stuff that AI can really do to restore the work-life balance that we have so missed in the last 30 years.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, I also don't believe that AI will remove humans. I think that it'll make humans better. And I think it'll give people balance and make, we work hard in the US, very, very hard. So like, we need a little bit of a little bit more balance in our life, especially, I mean, coming from an entrepreneur, like we work very
hard. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, I saw this one chart that I find so interesting. It showed the amount of people required to build the company that runs at $1 million per year. And it was like a graph, right? So you had the two axes, and on one axis you had like the amount of people, and the other axis you had like the date. And it was like in 1950, I'm going to make up numbers, it was like maybe you need like 50 people to build a company to a million. But then you fast forward and you look at it's like a reverse J curve. And then fast forward to 2024, it's like one person to make a company worth 1 million. And I feel like now, obviously you can't get less than one person, but you could have one person build a company to 2 million, to 3 million, to 5 million, to 10 million, to big, yeah. I don't know where the end is with the right tools, with the right AI.
I mean, I will say it's a little misleading graph though, because I've tested this. And the thing is that people don't consider inflation in the
Correct.
Picture. If
True.
You look at 60 years of inflation, that million is now worth 10 million. There's something we said about all the printing that we've done of the dollar in the last 30 years alone, 20 years alone. But that being said, definitely building products has become easier. But marketing and launching and having the attention span for longer durations has become much tougher. So like most things in life, I think there's a yin and yang to, wow, we can launch products faster because of the cost of engineering and the learning curve has come down, and YouTube and social and all this is helping. But I think like what Newtonian law is, like for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Because there's so many products that have been created, consumers are also being bombarded more. Attention spans are hard to actually retain. So I think net, nothing has changed. You know, I'm a firm believer of the more things change, the more they remain the same. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction in this case. You know?
If it's easier to build a product and we understand what good product is and what good design is, and we understand that once customers are there, good design, regardless of what that definition of design is, will make them stay. As an entrepreneur, how do you capture some of that awareness? Because design, the way you've described it, seems to affect and reduce the churn of the customer and creates a great experience and creates great repeat business. But then how do you become noisy in a super crowded marketplace where on the front end, maybe it's hard to see the optimized design and the reduced friction behind the scenes?
Well, I mean, trust compounds, and there's no shortcut to building that trust. You know, the bite-sized thing at a time, and that's the one of the biggest challenges and opportunities, even for us as a product design company, to say that, well, we can do all this stuff, but how do you start with just winning the trust of just one department, customer support, nothing else? I don't want to go to product management or software development or what have you. I think we have to, you know, I use the word gradual reveal, you know, which is the flip side of compounded trust, you know, trust compounds, which is the same as you reveal your, you know, stuff gradually. Even though you do a lot of things, how do you start with one step at a time? I think all of us are learning. I'm still struggling. I'm like, okay, every day I tell our employees, gradual reveal, don't blurt out everything, you know. Good news, if anything, should be delivered little at a time, you know, unlike bad news, which should be delivered all at once. And this is true in negotiation. I mean, one of my biggest mentors is Deepak Malhotra, who's a professor of negotiation at Harvard Business School. And he talks about this, that in a negotiation, when you really deliver good news, you don't deliver all of it at once. You deliver, you know, bite-sized good news, while negative news, bad news should be delivered all at once. So in this case, I think design thinking is also about gradual reveal. And the smaller you are initially, the more bite-sized you are, the fact that you got 2 minutes of their attention span probably is a good win. And then how do you create the recall and send them the notification, the update, the reminder, all this stuff, leaving a little bit of a subliminal thing in their heads as well. Like, yeah, I didn't remember one thing that in those 2 minutes as well, so that I can come back the next day for 3 minutes and 5 minutes and so on. To me, that's the most timeless sort of design problem that entrepreneurs are trying to solve now.
Love it. All right. Let's just wrap up with, I would say, a last thought. I always like to ask, because you've had an incredible career, I always like to ask if you would, you know, look back at your career and you'd have to tell your 20-year-old self one thing based on all the lessons you've learned, what would that thing be?
You know, and I've always thought about this, and I've always come to the same observation: learning languages. You know, in the midst of all the GPT and everything else, because it's the one thing, and you know, because there's religion, there's language, there's food, there's music, there's all the stuff that you can relate to other people with. I wish I had learned Japanese and German and Mandarin sooner in my life. I would have done so much more business with the people around, you know, just by relating to speaking their mother tongue. I think there's something about the endorphins and the oxytocins and the serotonins that actually secretes that. I mean, you just build great relationships. So more than food, more than music, which is more subtle things, you know, more than their movies and art and all this stuff, I think it's language. I would have loved to learn Mandarin, Japanese, German early on to actually go build, be a better entrepreneur.
I love that. It's a great lesson. I think that's like an underrated lesson. No one's ever said that on this show ever, but I think that's a massively underrated lesson, because then you show so much empathy meeting people where they are, as opposed to forcing them to communicate the way that you want to. I love that.
Absolutely.
All right. Where, if you have any other lessons, you feel free. The floor is yours, but I'll leave it with, I'll leave it with any website or social that you want to send people to. Where should they go? How do you want to connect with them? What's your, I mean, obviously you probably have LinkedIn for sure. Do you use anything else? Let me see. I have to find you.
Well, you know, I have sort of, again, in this reductive world, and I've said, okay, less Twitter, more LinkedIn.
Yes.
And, you know, my email is dp@devrev.ai. So people can send me an invite and I'll connect with them at dp@devrev.ai, you know.
Amazing.
But yeah, LinkedIn has become my one-stop shop to just talk to anybody and everybody.
Perfect. Okay. I appreciate you so much. That was a lot of fun. I appreciate what you're building. And thank you for, I think, just opening people's eyes up to how to be an empathetic and human-centric entrepreneur. I think it's a beautiful thing. That's why you're successful.
It's a pleasure. It's a journey, and it's a timeless journey. And I love every day I learn more things about relating to our employees, our partners, our customers, and end users. You know, that's the fun of building a company.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.